This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump praised the military and called on Americans to stay true to the cause in his Independence Day speech. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Hello, America. Hello.
On a hot, humid, and at times rainy night in the nation's capital, President Donald Trump spoke from the Lincoln Memorial on his Independence Day salute to America.
The spirit of American independence will never fade, never fail, but will reign forever and ever and ever.
Before the speech, critics had assailed Trump for politicizing the 4th of July, but the president stayed away from politics and stuck to his theme of praising the U.S. military for its bravery and sacrifices. The event was punctuated by military flyovers and the sounds of the U.S. Army Band. Mike Gracia, Washington.
An Iranian oil tanker suspected of carrying crude oil to Syria has been seized in the British territory of Gibraltar. The EU and United States have sanctions against Syria, and U.S. President Trump imposed sanctions on Iranian oil exports last year when he pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. This is the first time an EU nation has taken such a bold move to keep those sanctions intact. Meanwhile, AP correspondent John Gambrill reports the collapse of the Iran nuclear deal is putting Europe in a tight position.
Europe is trying to save the deal. It's come up with a plan called Instex, which it says will allow Iran to trade goods to Europe in exchange for other goods from Europe. And it stops individual companies in Europe from being paid directly by Iran. However, the U.S. has said that it's willing to potentially sanction this vehicle. That's a risk that a lot of international companies said they're not willing to take.
Choking off Iran's market for oil has severely damaged the Iranian economy. The Tunisian Coast Guard says that 83 African migrants drowned off the coast this week when their boat sank in the Mediterranean. Three people survived. The incident occurred just hours after launching from the Libyan town of Zuwara. This is VOA News. Reports from the news media, lawyers, and the federal government itself about conditions in migrant centers along the southern border with Mexico are bleak. U.S. Customs and Border Protection facilities containing thousands of unaccompanied children and adults who crossed into the U.S. without authorization in recent months are woefully overcrowded, substandard, and filthy. Many have gone without showers, adequate food, and water. The latest report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General, released Tuesday, calls for immediate improvements in five Texas holding facilities, with one primary recommendation, and that is to release people faster into the custody of other government agencies capable of handling the situation better. People in the U.S. state of California are regrouping after being rattled by a magnitude 6.4 earthquake in the southern part of the state Thursday morning. There were several fires and injuries as a result in the town of Ridgecrest. That's 180 kilometers northeast of Los Angeles. Seismologists say the seismic rupture occurred just 9 kilometers beneath the Earth's surface, which amplified the effect. Caltech seismologist Lucy Jones says Thursday's earthquake that struck near the town of Ridgecrest was not a surprise.
Europe has been saying that it wants to save the nuclear...
More than 100 aftershocks have shaken the region since the initial jolt. Experts say more are likely. Russian President Vladimir Putin has confirmed a military submersible vessel that caught fire, killing 14 crew members, was nuclear-powered, but he said it was not seriously damaged. Putin spoke to reporters about the Monday fire aboard the undersea watercraft at the Kremlin Thursday. According to a transcript released by the Russian government, he consulted with his defense minister before confirming the status of the nuclear power unit. The defense ministry says the fire broke out as the vessel was involved in data collecting in Russian waters. The ministry did not report the accident until the following day. That leaves some critics to suspect Russia has not told the full story. Norwegian officials who track radiation in those waters say they have not detected any irregularities. According to Reuters, Sudan's ruling military council and the country's pro-democracy movement have reached a power-sharing agreement, including a timetable for a transition to civilian rule. An African Union envoy said this on early Friday. Mohamed El Hassan Labat said that both sides agreed to form a joint sovereign council that will rule the country for 3 years or a little more. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, July 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. African leaders meet this weekend in Niger's capital to discuss continental free trade.
From a West African point of view, we are all, of course, very pleased that Nigeria will be signing onto this African continental free trade area because Nigeria is the largest economy on the continent.
Mohammed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel. Liberia's health representative passes a domestic violence bill. The number of cancer cases in Africa is growing, and the U.S. imposes a travel ban on a Malawian government official over corruption.
What the U.S. government has done is an indirect message to the Malawi government that probably they're not doing enough in the fight against corruption.
Vincent Kondowe is a Malawian political commentator. A civil society group calls on Malawi's development partners to impose more travel restrictions on corrupt Malawian officials. And France says it will fast-track the return of artifacts taken from Benin during the colonial era. Those stories plus Samse O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. African Union heads of state are meeting this weekend at an extraordinary summit in Niger's capital, Niamey, to discuss the African continental free trade area. Ahead of the meeting, Nigeria, Africa's largest economy and the most populous country, has agreed to sign the free trade protocol. Also earlier this month, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, adopted a single currency for the region. The summit in Niamey comes as the West African subregion continues to face security challenges from Boko Haram. Mohammed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel. He says Nigeria's acceptance to sign the free trade protocol and ECOWAS's adoption of a common currency will help boost trade not only in West Africa, but Africa as a whole.
The AU summit in Niamey is a maiden summit. This is the first time that the AU is meeting, and its focus is going to be on how to develop the right relationships between the AU and Africa's regional economic communities.
The issue of common currency in West Africa has been talked about for many years, and I think this year, finally, the region was able to do something. How would that fit in the context of this continental free trade?
The summit will focus also on advancing the African continental free trade area. And I must say that from a West African point of view, we are all, of course, very pleased that Nigeria will be signing onto this African continental free trade area because Nigeria is the largest economy on the continent. The continental free trade area will, to a large extent, also reinforce regional free trade areas. And this is where a common currency comes in. If you have a free trade area and it is matched also by a regional common currency, the impact, of course, will be to boost such free trade and easy commerce within the area.
Let's talk security in the West African region.
Certainly, for the West Africa and Sahel region, if I can say so, security remains a major preoccupation because of the threat of violent extremist terrorist groups in the Sahel in general, but also in the Lake Chad Basin area, where we continue to see Boko Haram terrorists continue to engage in attacks in Nigeria, in Niger, in Chad, and in Cameroon.
Politically, you have been touring a lot of West African countries or capitals, from Liberia to Togo. And then, so let's talk first politically in Togo. For the first time in several years, the opposition there agreed to take part in the June 30th election. How would you describe the political situation in Togo?
Regarding these particular elections which took place, this is the first time in 30 years that Togo has been able to hold local level elections. So they're significant.
You were in Liberia prior to the June 7th national protest against the government. How would you describe what is happening now in Liberia following those protests?
I think it was an important landmark because the fundamental issue at stake in Liberia was not only people's right and real ability to hold leaders to account, but also, on the other hand, government's ability and willingness to allow its citizens to do so in exercise of their constitutional rights to freely assembly and to peacefully protest against government.
Mr. Chambers, thank you very much again. We are so happy to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Batty, and we hope to stay in touch.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel. He's speaking with me from Ghana's capital, Accra. Liberia's House of Representatives has passed a law prohibiting all forms of domestic violence in the country. The Domestic Violence Act of 2019 acknowledges the spike in domestic violence in Liberia and notes that victims are among the most vulnerable. As Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia, the passage of the bill coincides with a peaceful march by youth campaigners calling on the government to do more in curtailing the wave of rape-related offenses in Liberia.
It took lawmakers more than 5 hours to pass one of the most debated legislations in the country. For 5 years, the bill lingered in the corridors of the legislature. Three joint committees, the Judiciary, Governance, and Gender, held numerous public hearings before reaching a consensus on a final draft. Grand Cru County Representative Fonati Kofa, chair of the Judiciary Committee, explained to his colleagues why it was necessary to pass a domestic violence bill into law.
One of the things we included in there is that the Ministry of Gender has to engage in extensive civic education on what constitutes a violation, what constitutes domestic violence, what constitutes acts that would be unlawful under this bill.
However, some lawmakers asked for more time to review the bill after expressing reservation about its effect on the culture of Liberia.
There are a lot of things indicated in this bill that really need thorough and deep understanding of our people. This bill is giving extra discretionary judiciary power to judges or to court to come up with additional fine as a compensation to the victim.
But Lofa County Representative Judy Fatoma Weah, chair of the Gender Committee in the House of Representatives, again pleaded with her colleagues and explained how important is the law in curtailing the wave of domestic violence in the country.
There is no perfect bill, but I think this bill is excellent because it addresses most of our issues, our day-to-day life, so that we can live in the life free of violence.
Finally, and with a unanimous vote, all 41 lawmakers voted to pass the law following motion from Bumming County Representative Ellen Snow.
So, Speaker, if you allow me while on my feet, I move that I can obtain a second that this bill be passed into law and sent to the Liberian Senate for its concurrence.
One key omission in the Liberia Domestic Violence Act of 2019 is the much talked about female genital mutilation, or FGM. According to Representative Kofa, FGM was not intentionally left out, but it is undergoing joint review by all sectors since it has customary attachment.
We are pleased that those who preside over our system of customary law are now moving into the realization that FGM as a practice has to end.
As the domestic violence bill was being debated, hundreds of young people marched through the streets of the capital Monrovia to draw the attention of President George Weah's government to what they say is a wide range of rape and domestic violence issues taking place in the country. The Domestic Violence Act will now be forwarded to the Liberian Senate. If both houses of the legislature approve, it will be signed into law by President George Weah. Moses Gazil, VOA News, Monrovia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, July 5th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The U.S. government has imposed a travel ban on a special advisor to Malawian President Peter Mutharika because of corruption charges. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau arrested Wladi Musa in 2017 alongside a senior immigration official on charges they fraudulently issued citizenship and passports to people from Burundi and Rwanda. Court documents show Musa committed the offense in 2013 when he was Minister of Home Affairs during the administration of former President Joyce Banda. Musa has denied the charges, but in a statement Wednesday, the U.S. State Department said it has credible information connecting Musa to corruption. Douglas Johnson is the public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Malawi.
We have laws about that under Section 7031C of the Department of State Foreign Appropriations Act. It makes us required to designate him as a person of corruption.
The U.S. government also extended the travel ban to Musa's spouse, Cecilia. Neither will be allowed to enter U.S. territory. Speaking to VOA Thursday, Musa said he is surprised with how the U.S. government has handled the matter.
That's the way they handle issues of diplomacy. Could you tell the embassy to furnish me with that information officially and diplomatically? Because I don't have any report of it. How do they know me? There are so many people who have got cases in court. Why only me?
Johnson said the ban was issued in Washington to a Malawian government, which he believes will communicate it to Musa. Political commentator Vincent Kondowe says the ban is a wake-up call for Malawi's government to address corruption.
What the U.S. government has done is an indirect message to the Malawi government that probably they're not doing enough in the fight against corruption. Remember that Wadi Musa is not just a junior public officer. He is a presidential advisor.
Kondowe said what the government could now do is to clear its image by removing Musa from his position until all court matters are resolved. Speaking to VOA, government spokesperson Mark Bottoman noted that the corruption scandal did not happen under the administration of the current president, Peter Mutharika. Bottoman said the government will monitor the situation before it reaches any decision on the matter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
A civil society organization is calling on Malawi's Western development partners to impose travel restrictions on all public officials involved in acts of corruption. The group says restrictions such as visa ban would serve as a strong deterrent to public corruption. The demands came after the United States government designated Oladi Musa President Mutharika's special advisor on parliamentary affairs for involvement in significant corruption. Charles Kajolokweka is the executive director of the Youth and Society in Malawi.
One of the reasons that corruption has proliferated in our country is because there have never been serious sanctions against those that are involved in corruption, particularly the ruling elite. They have been protected by the judiciary, they have been protected by the executive, and we have not seen justice happening. And this is the reason, for example, that the implicated cabinet minister had left the opposition to join the ruling party, and that has been the trend, and it has defeated the whole purpose of justice. It has rendered the anti-corruption bureau in the country useless because these individuals, particularly the politically connected thieves, have sought refuge and from the ruling party and have been protected by the leadership because of their political proximity to the presidency.
But some are saying that President Arthur Peter Mutharika is fighting against corruption, and he has made it clear some of the people who were engaged in acts of graft have been prosecuted or have been arraigned before the court. Isn't that enough?
Such sentiments and claims are basically ridiculous. They are not true because all the signs are very clear that the current administration is doing literally nothing in the fight against corruption. We are just coming from a huge corruption scandal in which he personally benefited about 145 million Malawi kwacha from a deal to do with food procurement by the Malawi Police Service.
His supporters are denying that President Arthur Peter Mutharika has been involved in any acts of graft or corruption because they are asking to provide empirical proof and that these are mere allegations to tarnish his reputation.
of course, what do you expect from such a group of corrupt individuals extortioning and the political sycophants? The Anti-Corruption Bureau in the country, clearly in its report that was leaked to the public, indicating that the president had benefited from a corruption scandal. And all those that were involved in that corruption scandal are currently answering corruption charges. His only safety at the moment is because the Constitution does not allow the prosecution of a sitting president.
Charles Kajolo-Wakard is the executive director of the Youth and Society in Malawi. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clote from the capital, Lilongwe. France says it will fast-track the return of 26 artifacts taken from Benin during the colonial era. Thursday's announcement came as leading European and African art experts met in Paris for talks on cultural cooperation and how to use Africa's heritage to power the continent's development. Lisa Bryan reports from the French capital.
Returning African artifacts taken by explorers and colonizers remains a hot-button issue in Europe-Africa relations, one that gained traction last November when French President Emmanuel Macron announced the return of the 26 historic artifacts to Benin. On Thursday, French Culture Minister Frank Riester said Paris will go ahead with the restitution without waiting for a new law to enshrine it. He said France will consider similar demands from other countries. Europe is believed to house about 90% of Africa's cultural heritage. Benin was the first country to formally ask France to give back the artifacts. Josie Plia, who heads Benin's National Heritage and Tourism Development Agency, NAPT, welcomes their pending return, though he says Benin now has to find a place to put them.
We are aware that the condition to receive those pieces are not already there. Why? Because we have museum there, but they are suffering a lot of waste management by the past.
The artifacts include thrones and statues taken in 1892 during a French colonial war against what was then the Kingdom of Dahomey. Benin is restoring and building museums and training curators to properly house these and other fragile objects. Plia says this initiative will take months, but he believes harnessing his country's rich culture can bring major job and development dividends.
Benin is a very rich country in terms of culture. We want to transform this culture in resources. And one way is the tourism.
France's restitution move has intensified pressure on other European governments to do likewise and given hope to other African countries. Hailu Zuleke, conservation chief at Ethiopia's Authority for Research and Conservation of Cultural Heritage, says a number of Ethiopian artifacts are housed in Britain as well as Italy.
We hope that the British also responds the same as the French. So we hope that this now things are changing to return our heritage to Africa, to their homeland.
Other experts believe cultural development delivers payoffs like less migration to Europe and greater stability. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The total number of cancer cases in Africa is growing, with breast and cervical cancer experiencing the highest rates of growth at 11% and 7% respectively over the past 6 years. Dr. Mashidiso Mote, the World Health Organization Regional Africa Director, spoke to Ricky Stryak about some of the causes of the increased cancer rates.
There are several reasons. I think first of all, of course, people are living longer, you know, even in Africa with the problems that we have with communicable diseases mainly. We see that we have people dying older, people living longer, so that increases the chances of getting cancer, and especially breast cancer. And then cervical cancer, we have still quite high rates of unsafe sexual behavior. So it's as you know, it's caused by a virus, so it's caused by infectious agents, in fact, human papillomavirus. And therefore, it means that there's still a lot to do in order to help people to adopt safer sexual practices, especially at a young age. And then we don't have yet in the region access to a preventive intervention like vaccines.
Do you think this represents a continued lack, I think not just in sub-Saharan Africa, but globally, of addressing the medical needs of women?
No, I think true of cancer generally. It's also true of the cancer that affects men, prostate cancer. That's also growing in numbers. Colorectal cancer, so gastrointestinal cancer, cancer of the stomach. I think that they, how can I say, they indicate generally a need for more emphasis on cancer and some of the risk factors that drive the increase in cancer. Of course, I have to say that in relation to cervical cancer and exposure through unprotected.
Dr. Mashidiso Mote is the World Health Organization Regional Africa Director. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Niger's capital, Niamey. Time for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports news in Egypt, where the round of 16 games is scheduled to start today through to the 8th of July 2019 to determine the 8th quarterfinalist. After achieving their first knockout stages qualification in 41 years, Ugandan Cranes are facing a tough mission when they take on Senegal's Teranga Lions at the Cairo International Stadium in the second of two games slated for today. Sebastian Desab is the head coach of the Cranes of Uganda.
We are qualified for the second round. It was the target of the federation, and I am very happy for that. And about Egypt, sure, you have some key players, and Salah scored in the key moment. I congratulate Egypt for the win.
In the meantime, Ugandan's players ended their boycott of the African Cup of Nations training after being promised an extra $6,000 each by the country's football association. The squad took to the pitch 3 hours behind schedule on Wednesday after securing the extra cash. The older Friday fixture will see Morocco trading tackles with Benin. On Saturday, Nigeria and Cameroon will renew their often bitter rivalry in Alexandria. Both teams are under pressure after finishing second in their groups. It will be the seventh encounter between Nigeria and Cameroon in the African Cup of Nations. Meanwhile, host Egypt need to get over their first round jitters as they meet South Africa. Bafana coach Stuart Baxter says his side will rise to the challenge of facing host Egypt because his players will want to prove a point to themselves as well as the fans.
We've got this opportunity now to play against the host nation in front of a load of people in a very, very hostile environment. And that's the time that you want people to stand up, and I think the group are looking forward to it.
Newcomers Madagascar, still unbeaten at the finals, will meet Democratic Republic of Congo in Alexandria on Sunday, while Algeria, arguably the most impressive team of the tournament so far, will face Guinea on the same day. Nicolas Dupuy is Madagascar's national team coach.
Congo is a very good team. 49 CIFA in March 2016. Before I was a coach, head coach, before the result of the score between Congo and Madagascar was 6-1.
The match between Ghana against Tunisia on Monday could go to penalties if the group stage is anything to go by, as Ghana drew two of their matches and Tunisia all three. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, July 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Thank you.